You're listening to BVRN, the Black Vault Radio Network.
Shadows of dark.
All right, well, we're going to see if we've got some sound here now, and everyone can maybe try to refresh if you're out there. Let's see if we've got this sound going here before we kind of get right back into things. Okay, it sounds like everybody is getting it here. All right, so that means we're going to move on here, and Bob, I hate to kind of really start over a little bit here, but it's, you know, I'm afraid that some may have missed us, missed what we were saying and all that. So let's just kind of start back a little bit. I'm going to read a little bit off your bio again, just for any of those who missed it. And I'm going to just double check here. Everybody is kind of getting back online, so everybody says good to go. All right, wonderful. And now, again, our guest is Bob Mayer, and he is a New York Times bestselling author. He has 38 books in publication with over 3 million copies, 3 million books in print, and is in demand as a team-building life change and leadership speaker and consultant for his Who There Wins, the Green Beret Way concepts. Bob graduated from West Point and served in the military as a Special Forces A-team leader and a teacher at the JFK Special Warfare Center and School. So, Bob, again, I apologize for a little bit of our technical difficulties there. So, again, can you tell us just a little bit more about yourself?
Basically, I did all that a lot of time in the military, about 10 years active duty, about 10 in the reserves with the first with the infantry and then Special Forces, commanding an A-team and teaching down at Fort Bragg. I got off active duty in about 90, and I moved to the Orient to study martial arts, and you can't do that all day long, so that's where I started writing. And my first book came out in 91, and then I wrote Area 51 in 1994. As we were talking earlier, that was before, well, at least before I was aware of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember I went to the library and was pulling every book I could find about it. And what got me intrigued with it was my ex-wife was a helicopter pilot, 101st Airborne, and she was deploying west to National Training Center, Southern California, and they had a divert around Nellis Air Force Base there, and she said they, you know, very strictly warned about flying into the airspace, and that's why I started investigating what was going on at Area 51.
And like I said, I don't know if anybody heard of some of it, but I did get a chance to read the novel myself, and I really enjoyed it. Because you talk about things within it that, you know, some people believe are true and, you know, in fact. I mean, you get into Area 51, there's that whole conspiracy theory around it. What is fact, what is fiction? It's a tough one. But can you give us maybe an example of some of the books that you did read without, you know, like I say, without the internet, that gave you some ideas for some of the characters in the book, some of the locations that you have them going to, as well as not just at Area 51 and Groom Lake?
Oh, gosh. I'm trying to think. The problems are all those. It was so long ago. All the people who had books out there, Whitley Strieber, Bob Lazar. And then what I did was I went out there to the area. I went to Dulce, which is also in the book, New Mexico, the various areas. And I talked to a bunch of people in the military. Fact and fiction, I think I just put it on my website. I was blogging about it. You know, 95% of what's in the series is fact. It's, you know, like the Sphinx is weathered by rain, you know, the Great Wall of China, Easter Island. I joke with people, I basically rewrote the history of mankind. The fiction comes in that I say aliens are behind it all.
Right.
So that, but pretty much anything that where I describe a place or describe something about the place is factual.
Right, yeah. And now also another question would be, being that you have a military background, I guess some of the military equipment that is talked about within the book would also be factual.
Yeah, I didn't speculate on any of the military equipment because I set it in present day. I just finished a book right now that's set in 2011, and with that I push forward. I use stuff that's real now but it's not deployed yet. But in the Area 51 books, anything military is realistic.
Oh, wow. Now, and we mentioned this before we realized we needed to kind of refresh everything and get started back again, and there's 9 books in the series in total, right?
Yeah, actually, there's 7 books in the main storyline. The 7th book is called Area 51, The Truth. I actually closed the storyline out. And then the next 2 books, Area 51, Nosferatu, and Area 51, Legend, were prequels. What I did was I wanted to go back and explain how this all started. Because the first book starts present day and moves forward, the entire series moves forward. And once I got to the end, there were so many people asking questions, you know, on how did this all come about? I went back and wrote 2 books to go before the timeline.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow, now that's interesting. Now you've got me all excited because I have got to finish reading this out because now, you know, I mean, because you do kind of leave you hanging there at the end. It's like, oh, man.
You know, all the books, it's very hard to write a series like that because what you have to do in each book is you have to satisfy a reader who just picks that book up, so you need an entire story in it, but you also have to satisfy the series.
Yes.
So it started getting very difficult to do. I think at the end of Area 51, the Sphinx, not giving anything great away, the last scene is they find the Ark of the Covenant. Mm. So the next book is called Area 51, the Grail. I have them open it up, and they look inside, and then I end the book, and everybody got upset saying, well, what's in there? I said, well, title of the next book, Area 51, the Grail.
Wow.
Not a big surprise.
Yeah, and it's, you know, same thing with, you know, I've read the first one in the series, and, you know, the story kind of closes out, but it still leads way because there's a discovery kind of at the end, and you're kind of...
Well,
right there
it's interesting. That last epilogue where the radio message goes out into space,
yes.
I did not plan a series with this. I had 2 book deals. The first book was a book called The Rock, which was also kind of science fiction. I wrote Area 51, and it did so well, the publisher came back and said, well, where's the next Area 51 book? So that epilogue of the message going to space, that was kind of my ode to Arthur C. Clarke's short story, The Sentinel, which was the basis for 2001. So I just pulled that epilogue, and it becomes the prologue of the second book, Area 51, The Reply.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started doing that with all the books. The last epilogue becomes the prologue of the next book.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about a few of the characters within the book and maybe the inspiration for them. Of course, one of the main ones is it Turcotte? Is that how you...
Turcotte, yeah.
Turcotte, who is in the military, and he kind of gets mixed up in all of this.
Yeah, I based him on some of the guys I know who would go shuttle between Special Forces and Delta Force, and I have him sort of, you know, be the black sheep in Delta Force that gets shipped off to this new unit, and he starts seeing all these strange things happening. And it's, you know, in classic fiction, he gets caught up in making the decision, do I do what I'm ordered to do, or do I do what I think is right?
Mm-hmm. Now, we have a question coming from the chat room from Cookie, asking that have you been to Area 51?
Not inside it, nope.
And that was the question, to get inside. And, you know, I guess very few people can probably say that. But have you ever maybe tried to inquire on it?
Well, the reality is, from my research, and this is the thing I think, I did a lot of work in covert ops, and my theory always is the thing you hear about is the cover story.
Yes.
So I actually don't think there's anything really weird going on at Area 51 other than test flights. If there's anything weird going on, it's going out someplace where you haven't heard of.
All right, and they've got kind of a follow-up question. I think we did touch on this, but I think it was before the sound and asking about where, you know, you got your information from, and you talked about going to libraries and pulling books. and so did we, you know, we kind of had that whole sound thing there. Were we talking about that beforehand?
Yeah, I also talked to a lot of people. The problem we also have, though, and this is something to take with a grain of salt when you talk to military, very few people who have had top secret classifications or a Q clearance classification are going to talk about anything because they do sign a oath, and then when they go off active duty or they retire, they sign another paper that says, I won't talk about what I did. So you're kind of in a catch-22 there, like, on who you're going to believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and let me put it out there to everyone, because we did have the sound problem. If you want to call in and maybe comment on what we're talking about, and you got a question, and like I said, now we are talking about a novel, by the way. Now there are factual locations and military equipment, things along those lines, but this is a novel, so just keep that in mind with your questions. But we have a toll-free number now for the continental U.S., and that is 877-430-9669. Anyone else needs to call 718-508-9887. Yeah, you know, you were talking about the message that was sent into space near the end. Excuse me, I seem to have something in my throat there. And you kind of, you open it up with a little bit of this, well, not even open it up, but there's a few other parts in it where it seems like someone is watching from the outside.
Yeah, I think the basics was, some of it was kind of the 2001 theory that if we reach a certain point in development, you know, we can either become an asset to a threat to somebody who's watching us. And the backstory to the book is that we're just a small piece of a huger warfare between two alien races. And I don't want to give too much away, but yeah, we have to be very careful on who knows what level we're at.
Right, and like I say, yeah, we're going to try our best to talk about this and not give not give everything away on it. But now you've some of your other characters in there. Was it Reynolds, the reporter?
Right.
So now, what kind of was her role within the book?
Her role originally, she was going to be the protagonist, but Turka kind of took over. And then as you go into the series, the woman who comes in at the end, Lisa Duncan, the president's science advisor, she and Turka pretty much are the leads for the next seven books. And I don't want to give it away, but there's a reason why they're not what they needed. What turned out a lot in the series was people weren't what they appeared to be.
Oh.
A lot of people had hidden agendas. Some people weren't even who they thought they felt themselves were, which can get confusing a little bit.
Yeah. Hmm. So now that makes me wonder, of course, when we talk about one of the other characters, the German scientist, what was his name?
He was based on the German scientists we brought over in Operation Paperclip at the end of World War II. I've done a lot of research on both Operation Paperclip and what we did with the Japanese with Unit 731. And it's kind of a dark period in history where we were willing to wipe some sins, a lot of sins clean to try to get scientific knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, you definitely, you know, and some of that, like I say, is known research can be done on it. So that's where you're bringing in this factual information, kind of putting it within there, and like say Operation Paperclip, and you know, even I think you even mentioned like a few other little operations here and there throughout the book as well.
Pretty much anything historical in the books is accurate. Like one book I was researching, Area 51, the Sphinx. So ended up with, I was reading a book about the Sphinx, and I found out Sir Richard Francis Burton had been there. And he's a fascinating character, so I read some bios of him, and I found that his wife, Isabella, burned a manuscript over his body after he died.
Mm-hmm.
So then the whole book came to follow Sir Richard Francis Burton's footsteps around the world and find the lost parts of his manuscript to figure out what he knew.
Hmm. And, you know, another one is, you know, you get talking about Antarctica, because there are a few scenes in the book where you know, it takes place in Antarctica, and there are definitely things that have been researched and talked about of covert operations taking place in Antarctica. Did you draw off of some of those as well?
Yeah, I was in 10th Special Forces Group, which was the cold weather unit, so my thesis was I'd frozen a lot, so I thought I'd write about something that's really cold. But the other fascinating thing about Antarctica is, technically speaking, by international treaty, there are supposed to be no weapons in Antarctica. So I, every time I hear something like that, I always turn it around and say, okay, well, that's the first place we'll put weapons. And then I think it was the Pyrie Rice, I don't know how to pronounce it, map, which they found, where they felt Antarctica wasn't originally where it is. It was actually might have been Atlantis or one of the lost continents. So I found that stuff kind of fascinating.
Yeah, and it definitely is. You know, like I said, we've talked about some of the covert operations on the show that have taken place on Earth, especially with, you know, the Nazi regime and Hitler kind of stashing things, you know, in Antarctica, and then some other expeditions down there to try to recover some of this and the falsehood that there was things down there. And I thought it was just a great tie-in to the book in terms of something along those lines.
Yeah, I like finding historical things that most people don't know about. I wrote a book at the gate where I used the two German submarines that the Germans loaded the uranium on at the end of World War II, and they sent them all the way around to Japan. And I actually read a classified OSS document where a guy claims the Japanese actually detonated an atomic bomb in Manchuria at the end of World War II, which hasn't been proven one way or the other, but it makes you wonder why the Russians were so anxious to get into Manchuria.
Oh, yeah. That is interesting. Now, of course, another aspect of the book, of course, is the what you call them bouncers.
Right.
And I really love some of the description of them. And can you just tell us a little bit about the bouncers?
The bouncers were basically the shuttlecraft for the mothership. And kind of part of what I did there is the problem they've got in the Air Force right now is the future of the Air Force is unmanned aircraft. Because we're getting to the point where we can design aircraft that can maneuver better than a human body can take it.
Right.
It can move G-forces. So right now you've got a lot of unmanned aerial vehicles being flown by people in the United States over Afghanistan and Iraq, and that is the future. The Air Force is fighting it. So the alien technology, they ran into the problem with that. The alien technology was almost too much for humans to handle.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I really liked about the bouncers was this, and I'm curious where you kind of, you know, got the idea, and maybe it's just something you kind of thought of would be pretty cool, but it describes as when the pilot sits down in flight, you know, they take flight, that they can see 360 degrees around them. It's like they're, I guess, looking through almost like they're flying a ball of glass, I guess, in a way, but they can see all around them.
Well, kind of that, some of that, too, is what we're doing now, technology-wise. I think about, like, an Apache pilot or Apache gunner with the flip-down sight. It's really difficult for them to operate because what they're doing is they have one eye that's looking out, and the other eye is actually looking at a thing right in front of them that can see something totally different. It's whatever they switch it to, they can see targeting, they can see their display, they can see night vision. So I kind of took that to an extreme.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, when I was reading that about them, I thought, man, that would actually be really, really cool to be in some kind of craft where when you were in it, it was, I guess, my understanding was it was almost like the whole of the craft was just invisible to the pilot.
Yeah, and I think that's possible now even with present-day technology. If they can transmit in and then, you know, every view from outside and then retransmit against the wall, with the interior wall of the aircraft.
Oh, right, yeah. It's just kind of like a big 360 television screen, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That would be interesting. That would be. Now, excuse me again. Well, it looks like we've got a caller on the line. Do you mind taking any calls? Are you fine with that?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Fine.
Okay, well, let's see if we can get them on. And I think they're using the click-to-talk here. Sometimes this doesn't work too well, so let's see if we can get them on. And let's get them unmuted here. Well, and then they hung up. So, all right. Well, I guess they don't want to talk after all. So, again, anyone out there listening, if you wish to call in, if you are in the continental U.S., we now have a toll-free number, 877-430-9669. Everyone else needs to call 718-508-9887. So we'd really appreciate hearing from you if you want to call in. Now, a little bit of some of the other stuff that you have worked on and done, and we'll come back to Area 51, but what about this Who Dares Wins, the Green Beret Way concept? So what exactly is this?
That's what I take the tactics and techniques we use in Special Forces out into the civilian world. I just sold the book, Who Dares Wins, the Green Beret Way to Conquer Fear and Succeed, to Simon & Schuster. It'll be out next year. And I do consulting with various businesses. And I've broken it down into, you know, how we trained people, how we went on operations, how we set goals, leadership, communication, and I use those templates in the civilian world.
Oh, wow. So you're kind of teaching leadership skills.
Basically goal setting, leadership, team building.
Oh, that's cool. And, you know, I work at a place where they do a lot of focus on that as well. I can't say we've ever had somebody from the military, I think, come in there and do something along those lines. Now, how long were you in the military?
I was active duty probably about 12 years and in the reserves for about 8 or 9 years.
Oh, wow. So you did quite some time in there. Well, first off, I have to say I appreciate that. you know, serving our country and keeping us safe. So thank you so much for that. Can't go past without saying that. So now, can you kind of, excuse me, you know, give us a little bit of maybe some of you, I mean, do you do exercises, things along those lines with this, with the Green Beret Way?
Yeah, I've got exercises throughout it, and I try to be very practical. I've listened to a lot of organizational speakers or motivational speakers, and they're really interesting, and then they walk out of the room, everybody feels good for about 5 minutes, and then you're kind of like, well, what did I get? Did I get anything practical? So I try to give people templates, you know, real things they could put down. Like, we have a thing called a Carver formula, and each letter stands for something where you can assess a problem you have, or an area study where you can assess the environment you're going into, how to do mission tasking, goal setting and aligning all your goals, how to analyze personnel using what we did in selection and assessment of special forces.
Mm-hmm. All right, here's another question coming from the chat room from Holistic Life Designs asking, you know, can you know, what's your security clearance? Can you tell us that?
I had a top secret clearance, and I don't ever talk about anything that I'm not allowed to talk about. The interesting thing is, pretty much anything you find open source on the internet, whether it's true or not, mm-hmm. you can talk about.
Right.
I basically don't talk about things I did.
Right.
A lot of what I knew that was classified back then has been overcome by world events, too, or technology has superseded things that were classified 15 years ago. Now, there's no reason to classify it because it's not important anymore.
Right. Okay. Now, did that help you in any way on doing some research for the book?
Oh, certainly did. I could, you know, one of the things when you have the background is you can listen to people speaking and you can tell, are they for real or are they, you know, kind of making things up. I always find it interesting when somebody I know will say, oh, I met this guy in a bar the other day and he told me he was a CIA sniper. And the first thing I tell him is, well, then he wasn't. He's sitting there telling you that he's not. So.
That makes sense, yeah. Yeah. That's kind of a good point. Now, you know, there has been here, you know, definitely, I know of some in the recent past, and some people have come forward saying they were, you know, secret CIA operatives or even economic hitmen. Do you, being that they're out talking about it, do you think that there's truth behind it?
My issue would be that they committed murder.
Right.
No statute of limitations on murder, so why would you be talking about it? You know, the people I know who did really dark stuff, you wouldn't ever imagine in the world that they did that, and they're very quiet people who have no need to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, we actually got a few of them coming on the show, so I'm kind of curious, because like I say, I mean, you know, they're out there saying that they're laying it all out on the line, and, I mean, my opinion, if they were, you know, releasing confidential information, that somebody would kind of shut them down after a while and say, okay, that's enough.
Well, I'm not sure. That's a big concern. People ask that a lot of times, you know, are you worried? Is there somebody sitting there in sort of like in 6 days at a condo reading all this stuff, trying to find, you know, who's somebody letting classified information out? And I don't really think so. They got too much other stuff to do. you know, I mean, the government is, and I hate to say it, I work for the government, it's not that efficient. It would be nice if it was that efficient, but it's really not.
Yeah, I think many of us see that, especially here recently, but it's all another thing. Now, you know, and I guess, too, along those lines, I mean, if they're really just telling stories and there's not really a lot to back it up, I guess in the government's, you know, perspective, well, there's not really a lot of worry there. It comes down to, you know, do they believe them or not kind of thing.
Yeah, and also some of it could be disinformation.
Right, yeah, very true.
It could be, actually, I do believe, if you study the history of the CIA, I mean, they were given a lot of funding for, you know, a lot of these groups that were so-called terrorist groups. The FBI actually started them and funded them just to, you know, turn things on its ear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find, you know, there's a book called Legacy of Ashes, the history of the CIA, and it was quite fascinating to read.
Oh, okay. Now, while we're kind of... can you let us know what your website is? We haven't said that yet, so we want to get that out there.
It's bobmayer.org, O-R-G.
Okay, and they can see your other books that you've written as well, not just Area 51. And if you could briefly just tell us a few other ones that you have written and kind of what they're along the lines, and then let's get back a little bit into Area 51.
in Lost, like the plane crashing in the jungle and the big creature coming in and snatching someone out, the dark mist, the whole concept of people surviving a plane crash they shouldn't have survived is actually the start of my first Atlantis book.
Mm-hmm. All right, and I think I dropped off a little bit there myself, so I apologize. Definitely some sound issues tonight, but it is, we're still there, so no fret there. We seem to have issues here and there with Skype and things along those lines. So let me apologize again for that. I always hate it when a show kind of gets a little messy sometimes.
That's no problem.
All right. Well, let's kind of get a little bit back into Area 51 and the novel and the series that you wrote. And, you know, I really want to know more about the other books, but I kind of don't as well because, you know, after reading the first one, it's like, now I want to read the rest. And it's like, man, I don't want to ruin anything. But can you kind of, without giving anything away, just kind of walk us through a little bit of the series?
The titles kind of give you a real good idea of how the series goes. The first book is just plain Area 51, and then that message goes out at the end of it. So the second book is Area 51, The Reply. The third book is Area 51, The Mission, and it's set in South America. And what they find is that someone's unleashed a biological weapon, and they have to contain that. And they trace it back to one of these alien groups. After The Mission, we go to Area 51, The Sphinx, where they have to find a secret place underneath the Great Sphinx in Egypt, which leads us to Area 51, The Grail. And then the sixth book is Area 51, Excalibur, where I actually use the Arthurian legend.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to find Excalibur because it's actually a key to something they need.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to the last book, Area 51, The Truth. And then I go way backwards in time to Area 51, Nosferatu, which is my vampire book, but basically I explain vampires by using the aliens and kind of explains where they started from.
Oh, wow. So you tie vampires kind of into it all.
Yeah, well, actually what I explain is that, it's not giving too much away, but ancient Egypt was ruled by the aliens, and they were the vampires, but they were actually aliens. And they were revolted against, and they had to scatter.
Huh. Wow, now that's interesting, because, in a way, you don't really say that they rule or anything, but in the Area 51, but talk about some of the structures possibly being alien architecture.
And there's various reasons. I explain in the series why the Great Pyramid was built, why the Great Wall of China was built, why what happened on Easter Island. I just like going into all these things that really don't have a solid explanation and say, okay, what if we can tie these together somehow?
Yeah. Now, what about some of your own thoughts on some of the theories that are out there about places like Easter Island and the Great Pyramids? Have you kind of formed your own theories, your own opinions by doing this research and for some of the characters or the basis of the story, of the novels?
My basic theory is we don't know as much as we think we know. People act like things are facts when they don't know they're facts. I mean, you can even watch the presidential or vice presidential debate, and they're throwing facts around that aren't facts. So I try to keep an open mind to things, realizing that maybe I don't know what I think I know, so let's examine all sides of this of the problem.
Mm-hmm. And we're kind of getting a question from the chat room from After Dark Radio, Anthea, and kind of along the lines of what we're saying here about, you know, what might be your opinion on why the pyramids were built, as well as she's even thrown in there the Great Wall of China.
Okay, and well, in the series, the pyramid, what I have is originally it was faced with smooth limestone,
mm-hmm.
and if it was, they projected out that the radar signature of that was significant, so it was actually built to signal out into space,
mm-hmm.
and then the Great Wall was built, it's actually built because it doesn't actually follow terrain correctly. It was built as also as a message, to send the message out to space because it can be seen from space.
Hmm. Now, did you have anything in your research that kind of showed that might be a good possibility? Because I know they did definitely believe that it was covered in smooth limestone.
Not that it was a possibility that's why it was built, but that's what it did do.
Right.
I mean, it did send a radar signature out into space, and the Great Wall is visible from space, the shape of it. So I just took that and said, well, what if someone actually did it for that reason?
Hmm. Yeah. And now she's bringing up another thing about the pyramids on Mars, in which, as I was reading it, I did kind of start thinking if anywhere in the series you kind of tie
Cydonia?
Yeah, I've got that in.
Matter of fact, the climax of the entire series happens right there on Mars, near Cydonia, the face on Mars and the pyramid and the fortress and all of that. One thing about Mars I found fascinating was all the missions to Mars that went wrong.
Right.
Didn't work. It was almost like somebody was deliberately keeping mankind from getting enough information.
Yeah, and they even had some, that were sabotaged before they even left the ground, didn't they?
Yeah, there's the one where they did meters instead of yards, which is unbelievable. Some of the mistakes that have been made.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of back to what we were talking about. So do you have a theory or opinion that you are willing to share on why maybe the pyramids were built?
I have absolutely no idea. I think it's kind of fascinating, the timeline of it. It could be just as simple as they need to keep people busy. You know, they do theorize it wasn't slave labor, that it was actually in the off-season of planting that they used the people. It could be just the people in power said, you know, we need to keep these people occupied. Ultimately, it could just be ego. Somebody said, you know, my mausoleum is going to be the bigger than anybody else's. But they did have a different belief system about the afterlife.
Yeah, they did. And, I've read about that whole theory of, basically keep people busy. There wasn't no agriculture or kind of going on at the time and the floods weren't up, and so you're like, hey, well, let's put them to work and let's just have them build something just massive. So,
idle hands are trouble.
Right.
A kingdom.
Right, yeah. Let's talk about a few more of the characters, within the book. And now, of course, you've got the main guy on the military side. His name, and excuse me if I am, some of these names were very, was something I felt comfortable to pronounce, but Golic, I think, was his last name.
Yeah, General Golic, yeah.
Yes.
Basically, you know, I'm looking around now, a lot of my classmates at West Point who are still in the Army are making one of, you know, the first or second stars, and I hate to say it, but, you know, it's a question of quality, who stayed in and who stayed out. I am getting quite concerned about, you know, especially in the Air Force, there's this sort of, I don't know, I'm seeing a big theme in the military lately that it's becoming very Christian, which there's nothing wrong with that, but the two are very distinct things. So I must base Golic on somebody who believes he has an absolute mission to accomplish, and he's not looking at all the possibilities of what could happen if he accomplishes that mission.
Yeah, and he is dead set on doing, you know, what he is out to do. Even with some telling him otherwise, that it could be dangerous, and he is
I like they started the super collider on September 10th. They're interviewing scientists,
yeah.
And they go, it's not likely it's going to destroy the world. I'm kind of like, even if you have to say that, you've got a problem.
Right, yeah. Well, and kind of bringing that up, I was reading some articles on it. It was like, oh, yeah, it won't make a black hole that sucks up the Earth, but it could very well make a black hole that sucks up Geneva.
Yeah, I remember reading one of Dan Simmons' books, and he talks about the big mistake of 08 or something like that, said 10 years ago, where they're looking back and they're saying, yeah, we shouldn't have done that one thing.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of is one of the things, that runs through the novel, this one in particular, 51, and that what they're working on, that they're not sure if the potential could cause, you know, a catastrophe worldwide, not just in the immediate location.
Yeah, and I think, you know, science is dangerous. Nanotechnology, I think, and I think I might have used that in one of the Area 51 books or the Atlantis books, but no, I think nanotechnology is very dangerous. People talk about nuclear, biological, chemical weapons. To me, the most dangerous weapons that are in development are biological weapons targeted to certain gene codes.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, you can't really use biological, chemical weapons because they're indiscriminate. They'll just kill whoever's in range. But if you can design a biological weapon that will only kill a certain type of gene code, that's a very scary concept.
Yeah, definitely. Now, one of the other characters, which I really like this guy because he's really kind of an outsider to it all, and just happened to be the guy who had kind of the key that they needed, and that's Mabinger. Is that how you would say it?
Mabinger, yeah, the scientist.
Yes.
Yeah, he and it's hard for me to remember. He, I think, has the key to the Bimini and where Atlantis was, and he's able to decrypt the tablets on Easter Island, the Rongo Rongo tablets, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And he also did a lot of the research on the Germans and what they had been doing.
Yeah, he was the one who had done a lot of study on the high runes.
Yeah, and that's real, too, the high runes. You know, there is a theory that languages around the world are connected, you know, way back when, basically. They kind of, you know, I think one of the things I talk about is, you know, how did civilization start? Did it start from one point and spread out, or did it start simultaneously
mm-hmm.
at different places?
Yeah, and that's, you know, that is something that I've thought about myself, and especially, you know, doing this show, we've talked about it many times, and you look around and there's a lot of similarities, you know, across the oceans. I mean, pyramids, for one. I mean, the Aztecs, the Mayans, they had pyramids, so the Egyptians, there's some in China. You know, these similarities worldwide make you really scratch your head and wonder, was there a central point, or was it, like I say, it was already kind of spread out somehow?
Yeah, I think in the third book, Area 51, The Mission, I go to China, and it's, you know, I'm not sure I can pronounce it, Kuen Lin, which is this huge tomb that's basically an earth pyramid. And I made the connection of that with the Great Sphinx. And I also go to South America to Tiahuanaco, where they have pyramids there. And I try to connect the dots to them, say they all kind of came from the same place.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of research had to go into this from your standpoint? I mean, how many hours? Because, I mean, not just talking one book, but, you know, in this series alone, not, you know, the other 31, I guess, or, well, 29, right? That'd be right, Matt. Get my math right there. But, you know, 9 in this series using...
Yeah, well, research is the fun part of being a writer, though. I always tell people being a writer is a great job, except for one thing, you've got to write. But other than that, it's a lot of fun. My current work that's at an agent right now that I'm trying to hopefully sell is based on American history. It's called the Jefferson Allegiance. And it was a lot of fun to research, you know, the founding fathers and history from there forward. I kind of cover, I want to start a series called the Presidential Series, where I do an ancient puzzle, not an ancient, but a puzzle based on a president that comes back present day to mess with our lives, and it's a thriller where they have to stop something just in time.
Oh, wow. That sounds interesting. Now, let's look at a few of the other characters within the book who play some major roles, and I'm curious of this Quinn guy, to be honest. You know, he's definitely follows orders. He, you know, does what Golic says to do no matter what. But he has that, you know, he kind of questions it in his mind and behind the scenes kind of stuff.
Well, that's the hard thing for the military. You do have to follow orders. You know, it's not the Nuremberg excuse, but it is, you know, that you can't sit around constantly questioning what you're doing because sometimes you have to take action. So he was kind of caught in the middle, and he was going to follow his orders, even though he's kind of wondering what the heck are we actually doing.
Now, does he appear in the other books in the series, or is that...
No, no, no. He was in the first book.
So that was, I was wondering if he would play any kind of role, you know, afterwards because of that, you know, just he wasn't sure what was going on. And, you know, although he followed his orders, it was still that, he wasn't sure about it himself. So, well, okay. Now, how many of some of these main characters, or even maybe some of the minor characters, follow along throughout the series?
Pretty much just only Turcotte and Duncan continue on. And there's a reason for that. As you get to the end of the series, you'll find out that the two of them are very, very special. But I just, you don't want to have too many characters, because if you have too many characters, your reader ends up knowing more than your characters do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the series, 51 series, got so complicated that I think about the fourth book, I actually had to bring in all my characters and have a meeting. And my editor said, you can't stop the book and have your characters have a meeting. You know, so I had to work that out a different way.
Yeah. that's pretty good. Now, you know, I really like this. You're all over the place. Like we talked about earlier, I mean, we're in Egypt, we're in Tennessee, we're in Nevada, you know, and you're out in the ocean. And you bring up, you know, I mean, all the bouncers, I mean, they can just move, you know, amazing distances in no time at all. But then you also bring up the Foo Fighters, which
right.
is an interesting subject in itself, whether you're talking fiction or nonfiction. And
yeah, and I've read accounts. That one, I kind of wonder what that is, because the Germans had accounts of them. The Americans had accounts of them. There's even a report that, you know, the Enola Gay was followed by Foo Fighters when it went on the mission. So I find that, you know, that's one of those people saw it. Nobody has an explanation for it.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it is. And I really like how you tie it into the book and you draw off, you know, those factual, you know, I guess you could call them factual, but the reports of them are following things around, and that's what they kind of become. Just, you know, somewhat of a, you know, they're following stuff around and popping up here and there, you know, when these bouncers take flight. And, you know, like I said, I've always found the Foo Fighters, and somebody's saying Foo, no, it's a Foo, F-O-O, Fighters. It's just an interesting thing because, I mean, nobody, like I said, nobody knows what they are, what they were.
Yeah, and there's so many reports of them all around the world, so there's got to be something to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned in the book, like say, these reports were starting around, what was it, the 40s?
Yeah, mm-hmm. During World War II.
Yeah. Mm, so something else, something else. Bob, we've got about, you know, 5-6 minutes left, so I want to, again, get out there, get your website out there, and where anyone can find the Area 51 series or, you know, any of the other books that you've written as well.
It's bobmayer.org, and actually I did a blog today where what I do is I run blog specials, so you can actually order the entire series off my blog for a lot less than you could get it in the bookstores. But if you go to Barnes & Noble or Walden Books and the science fiction section, they'll be racked. And I guess the thing we need to mention is they're written under a pen name.
Right, yeah, I was getting ready to, yeah.
I always forget that. They're written under the name Robert Daugherty. Yeah. Daugherty was my mother's maiden name, D-O-H-E-R-T-Y.
Okay, and now did I read correctly? You've also written under another pen name, or you don't have that?
I wrote the Atlantis series under Greg Donegan, but those books are out of print. I do have the first book in that series available on my website as a PDF download.
Oh.
My goal is eventually to bring these books back into print.
Oh, now just kind of briefly, what is kind of the basis of the Atlantis series?
The Atlantis series was kind of interesting. I always tell people to pitch a book in one sentence. For Atlantis, it was, what if the force that destroyed Atlantis comes back to threaten our present world?
Uh-huh.
What if there really was an Atlantis, something destroyed it, and now it's coming back and it's threatening what we have now?
Oh, wow. That sounds like an interesting one. And you even tie Atlantis into the Area 51 as well.
I'm not sure. I don't really remember if I do. Probably.
Well, yeah.
I think I'll be using Area 51 in various books, because a lot of it's because of the technology out there, the Aurora spy plane, the stealth fighters.
Yeah, and but yeah, there is a tie-in. It does start coming. Well, of course, Nabinger kind of starts talking about Atlantis. That's what brings him to Bimini to meet, I can't remember exactly what that lady's name was, that character. But he goes there to talk to her about these high runes, and they start talking about Atlantis. But more of a tie-in comes in near the end. Of course, don't want to give it away, but there is a big tie-in near the end dealing with Atlantis when it's kind of a little bit of the story is told.
Yeah, I eventually say exactly what happened at Atlantis in the Area 51 book. So that's why I had it backwards. I thought you were referring to Area 51 in the Atlantis series. But yeah, the Atlantis plays a big role in the Area 51 series.
Oh, yes, yes. That's why I'm sorry. I didn't mean to confuse things there. So. I apologize for that. Again, like we said, there is 9 books in the series, correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 9 books. And like I said, I got the chance to read the first one. I really enjoyed it. You know, before we say our goodbyes, you know, it's kind of went by so quickly, and we also, you know, had our little bit of trouble there the first 10 minutes or so. Anything that you want to mention about the series or any of your other books that we may have not got in there?
No, I think it's a really enjoyable series, and it's, you know, stood the test of time. The first book came out in 95. I think it's in its 16th printing right now, which in the current publishing world is really pretty difficult to do. Keeps going back to print. I had the film rights optioned, and Ron Shusett, who did Alien and Total Recall, wrote the screenplay, and actually I've got the rights back to the books now, which is kind of interesting since this all seems to be in the news a lot more lately.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Now, what might be a little bit of your take on that? I mean, we are seeing an increase of UFO reports and sightings, you know, in the UK and Canada have just, you know, said it's record-breaking. You got any thoughts on that?
Well, to be honest, I think in time in hard times, like one of the things you see, it may sound weird, in the romance world, the vampire books are so big right now. And I think to a certain extent, people are hoping that there is an answer outside of, you know, mankind that could help us out, because we don't seem to be doing too great of a job on our own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, definitely. And, yeah, I mean, it's just amazing what you see going on in the news. I mean, a good example, I'm trying to remember the paper that even printed it, but the O'Hare UFO sighting, you know, and then they, you know, front page fold, and then they have it on their website, and the website gets like a million hits in a day.
Yeah, people are fascinated by it.
Mm-hmm. They definitely are, and you know, we're seeing this increase in the UK and Canada. I mean, it's amazing right now, the interest that has just seemed to be fueled. And of course, the mod released their UFO files, which is an interesting thing in itself. So, and you know, and before we let you go, one other question: did you use some of the release files from the Freedom of Information Act as a basis for any of this?
Yeah, I did, actually. I read a lot of them. Of course, you know, they're so blacked out.
Yeah.
Some of them you can't really figure out what they're going on. I went to Roswell. That was kind of interesting, the UFO museum there and that whole thing out there. You know, everybody has a different opinion on things.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard people actually say things as absolute fact that I knew weren't fact, or they would deny facts, which is, so everybody has a different agenda.
Yeah, you're right. And I've been actually going through some of those here recently, and it was, you know, I got to one, and I think it was 10 pages were nothing but a big white block over the words, you know. It's like, well, thanks for releasing it, but, you know, that, so, but of course you got to understand national security and then releasing, you know, sensitive information. So, and, you know, who knows what's underneath those white blocks and black blocks. So we can only speculate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Bob, I want to say I really appreciate you coming on and joining us tonight. And one more time, let us know your website before we let you go.
It's www.bobmayer.org.
Wonderful. And like I said, you can check out the books there. And, you know, I hope I really, you know, want to let everyone know out there. I mean, I enjoyed it. I was so caught up in it. Honestly, it took me about 2 days to read. I think it was from cover to cover. So, I was really, really enjoyed it. I really did. So, well, Bob, thank you so much for coming on. And, you know, I hope you'll come back and join us sometime, and maybe we'll talk about a few other in the series or some of your other books as well.
Sure. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
All right. You're welcome. Well, Bob, you have a good night.
All right. Thanks.
All right, everyone. That was Bob Mayer. Make sure to check out that website at www.bobmayer.org. It is a good novel. I said we are talking about a novel tonight. We kind of broke away from all that factual stuff, but it does have factual things within the book, like you said, and it was a good read. I really enjoyed it. It was a great story, and you know, I think you've done just a fantastic job with it. I'm kind of waiting to get into the rest of the series myself. Well, we're going to take a quick little break, and when we return, we're going to talk with Robert Damon Schneck, who's a regular on the show here. Everyone loves him. And we're going to be talking about Salem and the witch trials. Robert just recently took a trip up to Salem, and he is just a research nut. So you know that he dove right in researching what was going on there, what happened there, what he was seeing. So I'm interested to hear about this trip up there and what he has to say about it. So everyone, hang tight. Don't go anywhere. We're going to be back in about, like I say, about 5 minutes with Robert Damon Schneck.
Visit www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com today to sign up for our free newsletter, join as a member of our forum, or browse our online store where you can find books, CDs, and DVDs, like a signed copy of The President's Vampire by Robert Damon Schneck, or the complete works of Dr. Gary Frick for only $20. That's four books signed by Dr. Frick that carry a great message. You also find downloadable products like Mysteries Magazine and the Donald Kehoe interviews, DVDs featuring Charlie Carlson and Mr. Lobo. So go to www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com today and be a part of the show.
Delia, oh Delia, Delia all my life. If I had the shot, poor Delia, I'd have had her for a wife. Delia, she was trifling. Delia, she was mean. The kind of evil make a man reach for his submachine. Delia's gone, one more round. Delia's gone. more unfaithful than any girl alive. Kind of woman to make me want to reach for my 45. Here you go, one more round. Here you go. Time I shot her, I got her in the side. It was hard to watch her suffer, but with the second shot she died. Here you go, one more round. Here you go. I'm a jailer, a jailer, jailer, I can't sleep. Cause all around the bed I hear the patter of "Do you sleep?" Here you go. One more round, here you go. Said, here you go. One more round, here you go.
No street lamps on the road I take. I'm not blessed with brakes. I've got no place to be. The things I love always get up and go. Life is late for a show. Well, late they'll always be. Cause just the little details that derail your dreams. As simple as it seems. The separate little things that you should have done. They define your life, honey, one by one. I may be living, but I'll die for an end. With no money to spend, there'll be no treasure to find. Cause nothing I do ever seems to get done. A lot of things get begun, but then they slip my mind. It's the little details that derail your dreams. As simple as it seems. The separate little things that you should have done. Define your life, honey, one by one. I've tried to run, but there ain't nowhere to run. Tried to hide, but there ain't nowhere to hide. I've looked for peace, honey, peace could not be found. I've done myself wrong and put my anchor down. And happiness, happiness is up in the hills. You can take your dollar bills and you can leave them behind. Emptiness, emptiness is up in my head. All the books that I've read just cleaned out my mind. It's the little details that derail your dreams. As simple as it seems. The separate little things that you should have done. They define your life, honey, one by one. I've tried to run, but there ain't nowhere to run. Tried to hide, but there ain't nowhere to hide. I've looked for peace, honey, peace could not be found. I've done myself wrong and put my anchor down. But the truth is this, I don't care if I belong when there's all these stupid songs all on the radio.
All right, everyone, we are back, and you are tuned in to Shadows in the Dark right here on Blog Talk Radio, as well as syndicated on the Black Vault Radio Network at blackvaultradio.com, as well as ParaX Network at para-x.com. Like I said, we're going to be joined this hour by Robert Damon Schneck. Many of you have heard him on the show many, many times. He is author of The President's Vampire, one of our favorites in the chat room, so let's get him on here. Robert, how are you today?
Good, Jeremiah. Good to be here.
Wonderful. And, you know, we were trying something a little new there behind the scenes, and it didn't quite go too well, did it?
Well, it was exciting. It's always exciting.
Yeah.
But I had a little slippery hand there and hit the wrong button. Fortunately, everything kept rolling on the other side, so that is wonderful. And, of course, let me let everyone know one of the new things we've got going on here is if you wish to call in tonight as we talk with Robert, we have a toll-free number. You can call in the continental U.S., 877-430-9669. Just set that up today, so cross your fingers that it works. But it should. I tested out earlier, and it did dial through, so. That is good. Well, Robert, you just recently, this past summer, took a trip to Salem.
Yes, I did. It was the first time I ever had a chance to go to Salem, and I said, well, I can't miss this opportunity because of all the places in the United States that someone like me should be visiting, that's it. I've never written about Salem, but I have written about Gloucester, which had its own strange things happening in 1692, just as the Salem witch trials were going on. But I really wanted a chance to see the place, get a feel for it, and I went out there with a question in mind that I never answered, which was, why do people come here? Mm-hmm. What brings all of these tourists, all of these tour buses, why do they have package tours to Salem? Because everyone acknowledges there were no witches at Salem. They all say that. And at the same time, then why are you here? What are you visiting? What is it you're enjoying? And like I said, I wish I could have come up with an answer to that question, but I never did. It was a fascinating place, though. Salem itself is beautiful. But when you get there, it's interesting. The Chamber of Commerce and the National Parks Commission, which runs a lot of the places in Salem, they always want to tell you, yes, the witches were here, but there's more to Salem than witches. That's you hear that over and over and over again, and they point out the important things that happened in the Industrial Revolution, in merchants in Salem, all of these things, but none of them matter. We're there for the witches. The witches are the thing that are keeping that place alive and are bringing in the tourists, and they know it.
Yeah.
They're unashamed of it, which they should. There's no reason why they should be. But what's interesting that what's happened in Salem over the past few years is it's become like a permanent Halloween at Salem. In fact, some people even call it the Halloween City, or where every day is Halloween.
Huh.
It's the witch city, where every day is Halloween. So they've opened up not only museums related to the witches and the witch trials, but they've opened up like the kind of things you'd expect to see by the seashore, a mad doctor's laboratory, all these bizarre wax museums. In fact, I was there just a few days before they opened up the first Lizzie Borden Museum, which is going to be open in Salem, even though she had no connection to Salem whatsoever. But that's where the tourists are.
And, you know, kind of mentioning about why, you know, people would visit Salem, and I've wondered that about, you know, other areas of, especially even talking about history, of dark times in history. And definitely Salem is a dark time in U.S. history, and why a fascination that people want to reflect back on when we were, you know, hanging people because we thought they were witches.
Right, and you know, the odd thing about Salem, though, is it's really a very jolly place. You walk around Salem, that you see people dressed as witches. You go into the souvenir shops, you'll see 20 different kinds of witch hats on sale for, you know, all the pointed hats and brooms and kitchen witches and little spells for sale. In fact, I went into a shop that's owned by Lori Cabot, who is Salem's official witch. And that woman markets herself just brilliantly. Everything in that place has her name on it, has her website on it. It's a very expensive store. There are love potions for sale, wolf fur, pentagrams, cups, pentacles, daggers, all of these things, robes, all of these things that can be used in ritual magic at quite a good price. It is not a cheap store. In fact, she does private readings in the back for also a good price.
Yeah.
She has really done quite a bit in making herself like the official witch of Salem and making a good living at it.
Oh, wow. And
a lot of that in Salem.
Yeah, and I guess there was. So now, I mean, you know, when you were there, did you see a struggle between those who want to just get past that history and not even talk about it with those who are trying to, I guess, kind of cash in on it?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because Salem is a place where people are always at loggerheads. When you look back at Salem in 1692, it was constant conflict. There were people who were fighting over whether they should keep Reverend Parris's minister or get rid of them. There was a struggle between the people who made their living from the sea and the people who made their living from the land. There were all these interests always fighting at each other, and it's still like that in Salem. You'll have these people who really want to be respectable, and for them respectable is having a dignified monument to what happened with the witches and avoiding the Frankenstein Wax Museum and the Mad Doctor's Laboratory, and preferably not even having those. So those are the two big, there are two large factions, the way I saw it in the time I was there, and that is, there are people who want it to be very dignified. In fact, one of the tour guides I was listening to said that he divided it up into history and hysteria, and he sniffed when he said hysteria. He didn't think very much of that stuff, because he said, you know, this is an important harbor. All these important historical things happened here. The witches were a minor element. Well, again, all that's true. And between these two groups that are almost fighting for the soul of Salem, if you want to be dramatic about it, there's a little tiny group that are there for Nathaniel Hawthorne, because he lived there, he wrote about it. It was actually very exciting for me, because I'm a big Hawthorne fan, and I got to see some of the places that he wrote about. But again, that's kind of a minor group in the larger struggle between how do we talk about this, how do we present it. For example, one of the last big things that happened in Salem a few years ago was they unveiled a statue of Elizabeth Montgomery as Samantha, riding a broomstick over on a cloud with a moon in the background, and there were fights in the city over whether this was appropriate. There were some people that said that the TV series Bewitched had a few episodes that took place in Salem, and some people trace the revival of Salem as a prosperous city to the interest that was raised by these TV episodes. There are other people who look at this statue of a grinning Elizabeth Montgomery on a broom, and they were appalled that something like that should be put up in Salem, a place where people were hanged for being witches. It's interesting. I spoke to some people that live in Salem, and one of them said that a fistfight actually broke out at the unveiling. But I looked that up later. It wasn't actually a fistfight. It was just a tiny little altercation. But it's interesting that he remembered it that way.
Right.
He remembered it as a fistfight, because I think that tells you something about the way Salem is set up, about these different groups that are jockeying for position. Even within the groups, of course, there are other groups. For example, among the occultists, there are Wiccans, there are pagans, some of who are Wiccans, some aren't. There are people who are a member of the OTO, which is the Ordo Templo Ordinalis, which was something founded by Aleister Crowley. In fact, one of the people I was talking to was telling me about a mixed relationship. He had a friend who's a Satanist, and his Satanist friend was dating a Wiccan, and they had to get past their religious differences, but they were trying to make a go of it. And I thought that's a real Salem romance.
Oh, wow. And you know, talking about the OTO, our last guest on the show, the one on Knocking Vision Magic, he was a member of that.
Oh, is he? Well, it's the same group. They have chapters all over the country, and they have a Salem chapter.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Now, what about, you know, was there a lot of monuments around? Anything kind of...
Well, apart from just the basic historical monuments of the founder of the city and Nathaniel Hawthorne, There is a relatively new monument that was put up just a few years ago, I think 2003, that was put up to the people that died, the 20 people that died in Salem. 19 of them were hanged, of course, and one of them was pressed to death under rocks. And what they did was, right by the Burying Point Cemetery, which is a beautiful old cemetery in Salem, they built this these two stone walls, and built into the stone walls are these boulder-like benches. They're almost like benches. I can't imagine sitting on one, though, because there are 20 of them, and each one represents one of the people that died during the Salem trials. Their names are carved into them with, I think, the date of their execution, but certainly their names are carved in. And I was walking through them, just going down them. Most people don't remember the names of the ones who died at Salem. They remember Rebecca Nurse because she was actually found innocent by the jury, and Judge Hawthorne sent the jury back until they came back with a guilty verdict because he was convinced this woman was guilty. Rebecca Nurse, Bridget Bishop, who was, I think, the first one hanged, George Burroughs, who was a minister who was hanged, Martha Carrier, who was called the Queen of Hell. So again, they have these stones with their names on them along these field stone walls. And as I was walking down them, looking at the different ones, I noticed that there had been some kind of a memorial to Rebecca Nurse, where they had burned candles had been burned, and flowers had been left, and notes had been left on her stone. So these things are actively being used to memorialize the victims of Salem. It's not just, here's a memorial, we've done our job, now let's open another wax museum. It was a really interesting and very beautiful place, and some of the words of the people were actually carved into the ground. For example, "Oh Lord, you know I am innocent," things like that. In fact, it was a little disturbing to find yourself walking on the words that the people had of what they said. I don't know if they did that deliberately, but it was a disturbing sensation to be walking on what these people said, because it's carved very lightly. You don't see it at first. But it's an experience. It's worth seeing. There's another monument to them in Danvers. I didn't go to Danvers because I was actually interested in seeing how Salem worked as a tourist attraction.
Right.
Because it raises so many interesting questions. Again, why is it a tourist attraction? Why do people come here? What do they get out of it? When they decide, let's take the kids to Salem for vacation, what are they thinking? And I honestly, like I said, I wish I could have come up with a better answer than I really don't know. If they say that there were no witches there, then are you going there to visit the site where a group of people were killed, were legally killed because of hysteria? And is that something you want to be celebrating or enjoying? It's a very complicated place. There's a lot of friction there. I've noticed it, a lot of friction, actually. You could feel it sometimes between people that want to approach it different ways. And I can understand that. It's not a comfortable place. It's a beautiful place, but not a comfortable place. It raises difficult issues. Still does after 300 years.
Well, looks like we got a caller on the line here. So
excellent.
Let's answer this one here and try one more time. Let me make sure. I think I unmuted him and muted him back. Caller from 386. What's your name? Where are you from?
It's Dr. Frank. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hey, Gary. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Are you calling on the toll-free number?
Yeah, yes.
All right, so it works.
I believe so. My question was, and I've been listening carefully, forgive me if you already answered it. Do you know anything about, like, any ghost hunting or energy that was left behind from the Salem witch trials period, anything that's been investigated in that matter?
there is a lot of ghost hunting in Salem. In fact, one of the places I visited was a place called Spellbound Tours, which is run by a woman named Molly Stewart. And she has regular ghost hunts through the Burying Point Cemetery and through some other places that have associations with the Salem Trials. And she has a little museum where she displays what she says are pictures of energy vortices and orbs and strange anomalies in the photographs. So there is a lot of ghost hunting does go on in Salem, and a lot of people believe that they have found evidence for ghosts there. She certainly does. In fact, it's an interesting little museum she has, because it's the first museum I've ever been in that actually dedicated, that a small section of it is actually dedicated to ghost hunting, where she explains the tools, how they work. It just has everything on display. It was an interesting place to visit.
Did you ever see the movie The Crucible?
No, but I've seen the play.
Oh, okay. The play. How accurate would you say the play is?
Arthur Miller went into that with, you know, very consciously went into that with the idea of, I'm going to use this as a political parable. And he did bend the historical parts of it to fit what he wanted to say about communism, the hysteria over communism. And it's an interesting thing, because as I was going through Salem, I was thinking to myself, do we come back here because we do regularly experience hysteria? We experienced the communist hysteria. A few years ago, we experienced the satanic abuse hysteria. There's still the remnants of that satanic abuse hysteria are still going on. There's still lots of people who believe it all happened. And I wondered at one point, is that why we're going back to Salem? To remember that this is what happens when you act precipitously on emotion without really thinking about what you're doing. I don't know. Like I said, it's a very frustrating place. At least it was for me.
Oh, yeah, you're talking about communism. The younger listeners may not realize this. Actually, it's before my time, too, and perhaps even yours. But there was a time when, if there was any hint whatsoever that you might be a communist, you could be blacklisted from your job.
Yes, you could be blacklisted.
So you're saying that kind of relates to Arthur Miller's play about Salem.
Well, that's what he was consciously talking about when he set out to write the play. He said, I'm going to write a play about communism or the Red Scare, and I'm going to put it in the context of Salem. Which made good sense. But again, he did change the story around because he had to also tell a good story, that's fine. I don't think many people would even know about Salem if it weren't for Arthur Miller.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, Gary, either we lost him or he hung up, one or the other, so.
Okay.
So, well, Gary, thanks so much for calling in. So I know you're out there listening, so thanks for that.
The toll-free number works.
Yes, it does. That's awesome. I'm glad we got that set up. And I don't know, maybe there's a time limit on it. I wouldn't think so, but we'll see. We'll keep using and see how it does. But then, of course, we have to have support for that as well, because it costs money. So, speaking of which, I hear you have a book.
Yes. Yes, and I hear you have an online store.
And I hear that book is in that online store.
Yes, you can visit the Shadows in the Dark online store and get an autographed copy of The President's Vampire. In fact, that was one of the things I also noticed in Salem when I was in Laurie Cabot's shop. She sells books, and she charges $5 extra when they're autographed.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting. But yeah, so if anyone is interested in Robert's book, The President's Vampire, just go to www.shadowsanddarkradio.com. Go to our store. Check it out. It is an autographed copy. So that's funny. We pick on you and your book, but you know what? It's a good book, though. It is a really good book. Now, you know, what did you find to be one of the most interesting things about Salem while you were there?
Well, one thing that really struck me was I visited a place called the Salem Witch Dungeon. Now, I thought that was going to be cheesy, to be honest, but it was not at all. In fact, what it was, they had a stage, and two actresses reenacted a small part of the witch trial, where one woman was denouncing the other with spectral evidence, talking about how she was seeing a yellow bird, she was being attacked by a yellow bird that was being sent by this woman. It was disturbing to listen to this, to hear the actual words being recited, because it gives you an idea of what an emotional pitch these people were in when the trials were going on. But then afterwards, they take you down a flight of stairs into a reproduction of the Salem prison, of where the witches were actually locked up, and it was horrific. Mm. It was a stone wall. The place was just a large stone room with a dirt floor, and they chained them to the walls. There were no lights. They were kept in complete darkness. Often, whenever it rained, the river would flood, so they would be ankle-deep, freezing. There were rats. And some of them were kept in something called coffin cells, which were literally cells the size of a coffin. They were locked in, and it was smaller than a closet. They could barely breathe in these things. And some people were kept in total darkness for months until their trials. There were children locked up down there, and old people and sick people. It was really a terrible thing to even go down into this reproduction. The idea of being down there in the real thing must have been a nightmare.
Oh,
and it took some of the fun out of all those pointed hats to actually be down there. It was unpleasant. I mean, if you've got any imagination, it was an unpleasant place to visit. And it did bring home some of what these people actually did go through.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned a little bit earlier about, the hangings and saying that two were pressed to death.
One was pressed.
One was pressed?
Yeah, a man named Giles Corey, who was, about 80, he was not pressed to death because of witchcraft. He was pressed to death because he refused to enter a plea of guilty or innocence. And what they would do is that they dug a shallow hole and they laid him down in it. They put a board over it and they started piling rocks on his chest until he would give them a plea of guilty or innocence. And he absolutely refused to plea, and it took him 3 days to die. But he did finally die. In fact, when you look at some of the old courtyards in Europe, you'll sometimes see a place referred to as the press yard. The press yard was where that was officially done, where they would press people.
Then a press yard?
In a press yard, yeah. They had a little press yard. And Giles Corey did this because he knew that if he pleaded innocent or guilty, if he was found guilty, which everyone was being found guilty, all of his property would be confiscated. And he didn't want his children to lose all their property. But Giles Corey was no angel. He helped send his wife, Martha Corey, to the gallows because he thought she was a witch. So it was a very complicated situation.
Hmm. Wow, that's a press yard. It just seems so barbaric.
Yeah, it is. But keep in mind, that had nothing to do with the witch trial.
Right,
That was simply a legal process at the time. It was not something special, especially barbaric that they thought of for the witches. Torture wasn't a big thing, but being locked down in those basements for months in darkness sounds pretty torturous. Also, they would charge you for the chains that kept you locked to the wall. In fact, one woman, even after the witch trials were over and she was exonerated as a witch, was in trouble for the rest of her life because she could never afford to pay for her own time in prison, even though she was exonerated. She had to pay for her chains. She had to pay for the horrible food. She had to pay for everything.
Mm. Now, as you were there, and you kind of mentioned about, families taking vacations, and, I've got four kids, and I can't, say once of me thinking, oh, I'm going to take them to Salem so they can see where, people were legally hung. Did you see a lot of kids?
Lots of kids, and they were having a good time. I guess the idea is that will give them a little history, and, the idea of witches is going to hold their interest.
Yeah.
And it's not really a question of it's not really a question of whether this is appropriate or not. It's just a question of this is interesting enough to hold their interest, so they'll actually pay attention to something. That's the only thing I could think of, because the reality of it was horrible. But the reality of what actually happened to these people isn't the whole story. I mean, the fact is that since the 19th century, it has been the witch city. It's also this tourist industry. It's also this fact that Salem has become almost a brand name. A lot of people don't realize that Ouija boards used to be manufactured in Salem. The plant there just closed a few years ago. But there is also this whole aspect of entertainment in Salem. And, of course, that's what's keeping their tourist business going. So, you know, it's a place, it's not a comfortable place. That would be my way of summing it up. It is not a comfortable place. There's a lot of tension there between the way things should be done, the way things are done, what people feel is appropriate or inappropriate. And, you know, it's also something to think about, the fact that there are descendants of the witches, the victims of the trial, still live there.
Yeah, right.
Descendants of Rebecca Nurse are still there. In fact, Joe Citro is very friendly with a descendant of Martha Carrier, the Queen of Hell.
Huh. Wow. I mean, that to me, if I was a descendant of someone from, you know, that was hung in the witch trials, I don't know if I'd still be living in the same town.
Well,
I just don't know. That's just kind of, you know, that's tough, because you know that you're also going to be around the descendants of the people who did the hangings.
Yes, yes, and that really did leave an impression on that place. I mean, Nathaniel Hawthorne was so haunted by what his grandfather had done that he changed the spelling of his name.
Right.
It was Judge Hawthorne, and it was Nathaniel Hawthorne. It really made a big impression on people for years. And, of course, you know, don't get the idea that Salem was the only witch trials
in
America. There were plenty of witch trials. In fact, right before Salem broke out in Boston, there was a trial of there was a family called Goodwin that was the children began acting like the children in Salem acted, and a woman called Goody Glover, who was their washerwoman, was hanged for it. But there is actual evidence that Goody Glover was a witch. She built little puppets, they called them little puppets of the children, and would torment them to try to hurt them by witchcraft. At least that's what the reports say.
Mm-hmm. And we've got two questions come from the chat room, but they were the same question being typed in at the same time. You know, saying, weren't the women in the witch trials accused of witchcraft just to confiscate their land, or that there was an economic basis behind them?
No, a lot of the women were poor.
Mm-hmm.
Giles Corey was probably the richest one, and he refused to plead. I don't think money played much of a part in what happened in Salem. I think people simply terrified themselves. I think it was an actual case of mass hysteria. I know people throw that word or those words around, and it's very difficult to define, but people scared themselves silly. And it's difficult for us to appreciate the Puritan mind. I don't think that they would have thought in terms of let's confiscate their land. That was just not so much of an issue to them. I mean, these were people that took things like piety, the church. They took them with deadly seriousness. I don't think they would have done it for any reason as small as that. And again, a lot of the witches were very poor.
Mm-hmm.
They gained very little from it.
So now, what was the main thing that started it all, that really started this mass hysteria?
Well, it was Dr. Griggs, actually. The children who were living in Samuel Parris's house. Samuel Parris was the minister of whom his congregation was fighting over all the time. They didn't pay him enough, which was just constant fighting in Salem. And two of the children started acting strangely. One was his daughter. I think one was a cousin. Two of the children started acting very strangely. One was almost in a coma. The other was flying around, was waving her arms and making animal sounds. And Dr. Griggs is the one who decided that whatever is wrong with them was beyond his knowledge. And he's the one who suggested that someone had an evil hand on them and that this was witchcraft. And that's what transformed some very strange behavior into a witch trial.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, keep in mind that New England at the time was under an enormous amount of pressure. They had been having a drought. There was a very good chance that they were going to go to war with France. They were in danger of having the charter of Massachusetts revoked, which meant that people would have to lose their claims to the land. It was just a terrible time in New England history. People were under a lot of pressure, and this might have contributed to what happened there. I know, for example, that when you're in Salem, you'll see the latest theory put up. For example, the ergot theory was popular about 2 years ago, that what happened in Salem, that the girls were acting strangely because of ergot poisoning. But, of course, why wasn't everyone else acting strangely because of ergot poisoning? And this year it was Lyme disease. They said children were acting strangely because they had Lyme disease. And years before that, they had other ideas that it was sexual repression or that it was a feminist reaction to the Puritan patriarchy. But all of these explanations tend to reflect what's current at the time, what's popular at the moment. There's always going to be a new theory about Salem, the way there's always a new theory about Atlantis, a new theory about this, a new theory about that, but they tend to reflect what's popular at the time, not what really happened.
Yeah.
You don't know what happened.
Yeah, that's true.
These were people for whom witchcraft was an important part of the real world. It wasn't a joke. It wasn't a... wasn't something that crazy people believed in. It was a part of their worldview, and an important part, one that actually tended to prove the existence of God, because the existence of witches, the existence of the devil, ergo God exists. So it was not something that they approached lightly or frivolously, but with genuine fear. I mean, the way... to call someone a witch then would be like calling someone a child molester now. It would be a permanent stain. It would be something that they could never quite get past. There would always be that suspicion among the neighbors, just like there is now.
All right. Now, what kind of finally put it all to an end?
Oh, well, almost everybody was being accused of being a witch. The governor's wife was being accused of being a witch. Cotton Mather was being accused of being a witch. It was just completely out of control. The prisons were full. I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of people were chained up in all these different prisons all over. It wasn't just Salem. It was also the surrounding towns.
Yeah.
In fact, at one point in Gloucester, a man named Ebenezer Babson, who was at the center of those phantom soldiers that was also happening at the same time in Gloucester, he actually imported some of the girls from Salem who were having the fits because they claimed they could see the witches, the invisible witches. He imported them because his mother was having problems with witches, and he wanted to see if they could see the witches that were attacking her. So these girls were almost on the road, going to these other towns and finding witches there, too. It really got out of control, but again, it was an extremely tense, difficult time in Salem's history.
Hmm.
And this seems to be one of the ways it manifested.
Now, you know, kind of talking about the Puritans, what about their views on a paranormal phenomena? I mean, here we were talking about witches, and we definitely see that, you know, they thought that was evil and a possibility. They believed it was true.
Well, the Puritans had the Puritans did not ignore paranormal phenomena by any means. They believed in things called miraculous providences. That is to say that the phenomena occurred, whether they came from God or the devil, was something that we had to figure out. And that they believed in omens. They believed that things that they saw in the sky, comets, earthquakes, things like that, could very well be messages from God if they were interpreted properly. One of the real problems with spectral evidence, that is to say, a person would claim that the spirit of this woman is tormenting me, so she's a witch. That's spectral evidence. And one of the big arguments was, well, maybe the devil is taking the form of this innocent person in order to have them destroyed. And that's actually why spectral evidence was eventually gotten rid of. There had been arguments about it for years, but most people were against using spectral evidence in the criminal case, but it was accepted for some reason. It was accepted in Salem.
Hmm. Now, we've got another question from the chat from Dr. Frick, and I'm trying to get a little bit more clarification on it because he's asking, were other areas of the country much better than Salem?
Well, there were other trials going on, but those people weren't being hanged.
Mm-hmm.
Salem got so much attention because so many people were hanged. No place else in the United States were so many people hanged for witchcraft, certainly not so quickly. I mean, they were all hanged within a few months.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was, again, you go through the old records, you'll find a person was hanged for witchcraft in New Jersey, one or two were hanged in New York, one or two were hanged someplace else, but that was it. It was always a small local phenomenon, not this mass phenomenon. In fact, Cotton Mather believed that what was happening was that the armies of the devil were finally making their last move, that they were going to destroy the Puritan community, this community that was dedicated to the Puritan ideals of religion and how to act, the Puritan theocracy, and that these witches were a very important part of that army. And that's why the idea of hundreds of witches made sense to him, because it was an army of witches that were going to destroy the Puritan society.
Hmm. Now, you know, you talk about mass hysteria, and we've definitely seen, well, I mean, good example there, but what it can do, another example is, the whole Orson Welles War of the Worlds that just sent people in mass hysteria, just acted crazy ways.
It did, but, you know, it's a funny thing. That was kind of exaggerated by the newspapers at the time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a lot of the incidents they point to, no one's ever really been able to authenticate them. There was a lot of tension between the newspapers and the radios at the time, and apparently the newspapers exaggerated the hysteria with the idea that they were going to show that the radio was an unreliable source of information.
Right. Right.
And, of course, those good stories sold good papers.
Yeah, very true. Very true. So, but now in this case, though, we have the records to back up the what happened out of this mass hysteria.
Right. And, of course, you know, the thing to remember is it's not like everybody believed these women were witches. Mm-hmm. Even while the trials were going on, there were people saying, you shouldn't be doing this.
Right.
This is a mistake. Cotton Mather has gotten a lot of the blame for what happened at Salem, even though he had very little to do with it. But he was friendly with all the judges. He'd known them his whole life. He knew that they were good men, they were pious men, they were men he knew from government, he knew from church, and he simply could not believe that they would be sending innocent people to the deaths. That was simply something, it didn't fit into his view of the world. Good, godly people don't do that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, for those that did kind of back him up, did they try to turn around and say, well, you must be a witch too?
Well, that's what they say happened. I don't know. I suppose that might have happened every now and then, but some of the defenders of the witches were prominent ministers. And they weren't going to be accused of that. George Burroughs was a minister, and he ended up getting hanged. But there were other questions about him. He was believed to be possibly the head of the satanic army that was getting ready to destroy the Puritan society. So he was kind of an exceptional case. But Increase Mather, who was Cotton Mather's father and probably the single most respected minister in New England, he thought spectral evidence was ridiculous. He wasn't in New England at the time. He was actually in England at the time. But had he been there, maybe the story would have been a little different.
Hmm. Yeah, that is. That's true. That's a good point. Good point. Now, you know, once, you know, you how long did you spend there in Salem?
I was just there for a few days. I wish I could have spent longer because I would have liked to just soak up some more of the place. It, as I said, it's a beautiful place and it's a complicated place.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, upon leaving, did you have, you know, did you have different thoughts on it after you, you know, were there and spent a couple of days? Did you have a difference of opinion?
I think what really the single thing that stuck in my mind the most was the tension that still exists in Salem, and how divisive things like paranormal can be, or the suggestion of the paranormal can be, and how complicated things can be when you start adding commerce and tourism and history and the fact that real people suffered and died. And how do we deal with this in a dignified way, and yet how do we bring in the tourists and make the money?
Mm-hmm.
It, like I said, it's a complicated city, and it raises difficult questions, questions that are as difficult now as they were then, and fortunately no one gets hanged for it now, but it's definitely a place worth visiting, and if nothing else, go because it's beautiful.
All right. Now, well, we've got a, another question from Dr. Frick. So the United States was still under British control during the trials. How did this factor into the hysteria?
Well, technically, the New England colony had its own charter. It was not a it was not a colony in the sense that it was not a royal colony that was ruled directly by the crown. It wasn't a crown colony, which is later what it became. It was very, it was much more independent than the typical colony. The Puritans had their own form of government. They elected their own leaders. It was, of course, it was heavily dominated by the church. And the Anglican church barely even existed in New England at the time. It was, this was something that the Puritans did. Afterwards, it became a much more conventional colony. By the beginning of the 18th century, just a few years later, it was just a it was a crown colony like many other colonies. So it was then under British rule. But when the Salem witch trials were going on, it was under Puritan rule.
Okay.
One other thing to mention is a 3-month boat ride from New England to Britain at the time. So it's not like there's a problem and we'll just call the king and see what he thinks.
Right.
It could take you 6 months to find out. So the whole Salem witch hysteria lasted only about 8 months.
Right.
So it was, even if it had been a crown colony under crown control, who knows what might have happened? Who knows? It still could have happened. I suspect it wouldn't have been as severe.
Mm-hmm. Well, wow, you know, I never really thought about that, about the trip across the ocean to deal with something like that.
It was dangerous and slow.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they had the bouncers.
It would have helped.
but
you also, to put it in perspective a little bit on the witch hunting, keep in mind that 20 people were hanged at Salem, 19 people hanged at Salem, one pressed to death. That was horrible. But when you start to look at the numbers of people that died in the witch persecutions in Europe, it almost seems negligible. You talk about 200 people died in this one German city, 180 died in this one French town, 600 people died in this one Spanish city. Not to play down the deaths of these people, but when you put it against the horrific things that happened in Europe, it seems relatively small. But that's, I think part of that is one of the reasons why it's approachable. All of these people had names. All of these people had families and histories, and we can look at them as individuals rather than simply statistics.
Right. Yeah, that's true. It's very real.
Exactly. You know, again, when it's only 20 names on 20 boulders, each one of those is an individual. You walk into a, you go into a city that had 1,800 people die in the witch persecutions. Well, what do? It's simply too much. You can't absorb all that.
Mm-hmm.
20 people can sit on a bus.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, it is, it's very real. And like I say, it's just a very dark time. In U.S. history, we have much of them, but this is, you know, definitely one that...
That's pre-U.S. history.
Yeah, true. And, you know, but it's one that stays kind of in the forefront of, you know, a lot of our history. It seems to still even be, you know, a topic of interest for many people.
It does. I mean, why else would people still be coming out with new theories about what happened in Salem? Literally every year or two, we get a new theory.
Mm-hmm.
Or an old theory that's being revisited with new evidence. And some of these theories are ingenious. I mean, the ergot theory and all that, I don't believe it, but it is, it can be very convincing.
Yeah. Now, is there one in particular that you kind of sway towards more than the rest?
No, my theory is always the same, that the theory tells you more about the theorizer than what actually happened.
Right. Okay.
That's my response to the paranormal. That's my response to what happened in Salem. Again, the theory tells you more about the theorizer.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, now, anything we didn't touch on that you want to get out there? We've got about 5 minutes or so left.
Nothing specific, although, again, I will recommend that people go to Salem, go to Danvers, see those places, because they really are, for anyone who's interested in the paranormal, so many things happened there. The first sea serpent in the New World was seen off the coast of Cape Ann. Off the coast of Gloucester, a gigantic black sea serpent used to visit every summer for years and years and years. The Gloucester serpent was famous. There are many more witch trials in that area. There were the phantom soldiers that attacked Gloucester in 1692.
Yeah.
There were poltergeist cases. There were cases of possession. In fact, a lot of people thought that the girls in Salem were possessed, not bewitched. So that was another thing that people were arguing about at the time. And it's worth visiting also to see these places, to see the different ways that what happened is presented. For example, in the very famous witch museum, the one that you see on all the postcards, it's in an old church or something. In the back, after they give you the presentation and a brief history of what happened at the trials, you go through a little museum in the back, and it's dedicated to Wiccans almost, and they talk about how what Wiccans believe and what why they call themselves witches and all of these things. And it's odd because you get the feeling that they're trying to appropriate the history of persecution for themselves. It's like, well, you see all that we suffered. No, you didn't suffer. You weren't there. These were Puritans who were tormenting other Puritans. Had they realized that they were being made the ancestors to modern Wiccans, they'd be appalled.
Yeah. Now, for anybody who may, you know, hasn't been there and maybe, you know, eventually make their way up there, of course now it's very hard. If you can find the gas and want to pay $4 or $5 a gallon for it.
you can take the train. There's a train called the Northeaster that does stop very close to Salem.
There we go. What are some of the places, a few of the places you say you can't pass up that you have to go visit it?
You have to visit the monument to the people in Salem, the ones who died. You have to see the old Burying Point Cemetery, which is where Judge Hawthorne is buried, and a lot of the people that were involved in what happened there. I found a visit to Judge Corwin's home. It's called the Witch House. But I found the visit to Judge Corwin's home absolutely fascinating. It's in a different spot than where it was originally. But here was a genuine late medieval 17th century house. Still looks exactly the same way it did then. They've restored it as much as they could. And you go through this place, and suddenly it all gets very real. Salem is an interesting place because history reaches right up and grabs you sometimes. And when I was at Judge Corwin's house, there was no one else there. And I just spent think, a half hour just sitting in his old bedroom, really being in the place that he inhabited. It's a very peculiar sensation to be in the actual spot where these things occurred. And like I said, it makes it all very real.
Wow, yeah. I hope to get up there one day myself and see this. You know, just, you know, I enjoy seeing the history of our, you know, our continent, our country, and kind of where it came from, and this is a huge part of it, for sure. Well, Robert, one more time, what is that book again?
That book is The President's Vampire. What I understand, you can get an autographed copy. Autographed, mind you, at no extra charge, unlike certain official witches I could name. Autographed copy is available at the Shadows in the Dark online store.
That is right, and all you have to do
along
is...
Along with many other fine books.
Yes, and all you have to do is go to www.shadowsanddarkradio.com and click on the link that says store. And yes, we do have other books in there as well. And you had mentioned Joe Citra. We have some of his books in there.
We have Joe Citra. We have Gary Frick.
Mm-hmm.
We have downloads. We've got DVDs and CDs. It's wonderful.
That is right. Yeah, Dr. Gary Frick is hanging out in the chat room with him. We got four books of his in there, which you can buy all four for $20, $5 a piece. You know, all same thing.
With a stick.
Same thing. Autographed copies. See, there we go.
Right.
Autographed copies. So yeah, check that out, along with our forum, which of course Robert is a part of as well, and you can go in there and partake and post along with us. Which, yes, we need some posters. We really, really do. So get in there and post away. Robert, again, thank you so much for joining us and being such a big part of the show.
My pleasure, Jeremiah. Anytime.
And of course, you're going to be with us this Thursday as we have our paranormal roundtable.
That's right.
That's right. So we're going to have a paranormal roundtable. You're going to be joined by you as well as Tracy Austin from Let's Talk Paranormal and maybe Charlie Carlson. We're not sure because, of course, with Dot being sick right now and in the hospital, again, we want everybody to kind of send your thoughts and prayers her way. I talked to him a few days ago, and he just said it kind of depends on what goes on with that because he is spending most of his days in the hospital right now by her side. So we may have to get somebody else to fill in, but again, we're still going to do it.
Okay.
So that sounds good. Well, everybody, you know, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's such a great turnout once again in the chat room. So thanks to all those who piled in there as well. You know, all the way from Superior Awesomeness, all the way from Sweden tuning in. We got Anthea, Dr. Gary Frick, of course, Knock, which is Robert, is still hanging out in the chat room. LCGH, Justin there, Jamie and Bill Tracer, Excel and Night Owl, Alav popped in here here just recently, Lone Wolf. You know, we really appreciate the support that you do, everyone shows for the show, not only just the listeners, but the guests as well. We see such a great support from everyone. So, again, make sure to check out our website, www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com. We've got a lot of great shows coming up. You can see those there on the website itself. You can check out our web store. Just click on the link that says store, as well as you can click on the link that says form. We've got book reviews. We are really expanding here, so make sure and check it out, everyone. We really appreciate you tuning in. Again, this has been Shadows in the Dark, where the darkness is illuminated. And we'll see everybody Thursday, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, as we do our roundtable. Good night, everybody.
Shadows.